Six music.
BBC Radio, six music documentaries.
I'm Matt Everett and welcome to The First Time. This is the show on Six Music where we speak to some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around about the significant musical firsts that have shaped their lives and their careers. It's very rare that people intentionally break up their band right at the height of its fame, but that's what my guest today did. Following three brilliant albums and 10 years together, LCD Sound System played their last ever show at Madison Square Gardens in New York in April 2011, simply because, as their founder said, they didn't want to ruin everything they'd achieved by just carrying on and becoming another band. This says a lot about the group's founder and singer, James Murphy. He's a man who thinks a lot about his music and how he relates to it. From his time as a musician in underground New York bands to being a sound engineer, then a DJ and a remixer and a producer and a record label boss with Death From Above, he's always challenging himself to do something different, to stay interested. This is something that makes him one of the most fascinating people in modern music. Here, James talks about being literally obsessed with music as a child and the bands that inspired him, as well as LCD's career and what led him to disband the group. He also discusses the myriad of other projects that have followed in the wake of the group split, including producing Arcade Fire, remixing David Bowie, and launching his own coffee brand. But I started by asking, as I do with all my guests, when was he first aware of music?
I honestly don't remember not being aware of music. I honestly don't remember a time before music.
Because I remember you saying once that the sound made by electronic equipment...
Yeah, refrigerators and stuff.
You kind of saw as being music.
Primarily refrigerators and humidifiers, the old spinning type of humidifier. Any humming machines I really liked. But that's always...
Even to this day?
I still sing if I'm near... I have all these songs that they're like... If I was a culture instead of a person, there would be like traditional... like rogs or lines that I sing.
Folk songs.
Yeah, that are like, well, they're not even, they're just like lines of notes that are really long and don't really have anything to do with 4/4 time or anything like that, that I sing to machines that I've sung since I was a little kid. I think I was in my 30s before I realized I wrote them. I never questioned it. It wasn't like I wrote them or not. They just came from someplace else and they were just always there. Sort of like growing up in a culture where you like sing stories or something and they're always in my head, so... whenever I'm near machines, I just sit there and sing them. I'm like standing there in machines and I'm singing them. When I learned to scuba dive, there was someone with a propulsion, like the boat motor, you could hear, and I'm just singing to myself in the water. My old refrigerator where I grew up, it's like an old crappy American refrigerator from the 60s. I think that's like the one, that was the machine that really did it for me. And later on, I would pursue that with, I always had a humidifier all year round. And actually, I remember when I was about 16, I realized it was rusting my guitars, so I had to stop using the... Because I was just like, I was running it just for the sound. Yeah, things like that make me quite happy.
What about the first musical obsessions of yours?
Well, I started as a guitar player. I didn't pick up drums till I was in my 20s. I mean, I don't know. I never had like guitar heroes that I wanted to be like.
You never wanted to be an axe man?
No, I mean, because I was never that good at it. And the guitar was always like a means to an end of like making music. And it was always a frustrating instrument for me. I was never quite good enough at it. I was always very right-handed. Like the things I really liked were like certain guitar sounds in B-52s, guitar sounds in Gang of Four, like Entertainment, like things that were like quite hacking. But I was never like a guitar guy. I didn't want to like shred or play solos or anything like that. In fact, I was always kind of turned off by that. It could be like either jagged or kind of hypnotic. Those are the things I kind of liked the most. So like Robert Smith, like early Cure, like 17 Seconds, Faith era, like really hypnotic guitar. And then you had like sort of like the last minute of Rock Lobster or Everything on Entertainment, which is really jagged. And those are the kinds of two things I really liked the most, I think.
We have to talk about the first record that really made an impact on you.
There's a couple. My first records ever were 2 7-inches, and they were Fame by David Bowie, because my brother had David Live. My brother was like a rock guy and a prog guy. Like, he listened to a lot of like Utopia and Zeppelin and Pink Floyd. Yes, a lot of Yes. He's 10 years older than me. So whatever he listened to, I thought was just cool. And I remember seeing the David Live record cover, like leaning against the little milk crate in his bedroom.
He looks skeletal on that
cover. Really scary to me in a way. Yeah. I was probably like 7, you know. And my brother's like, that's the original punk rocker. My brother's not into punk rock, because he was like, you know, this is the real deal, this guy, before any punk rock, which I think was like kind of prescient for my, you know, suburban New Jersey brother in 1977. So I bought Fame and Gilbert O'Sullivan Alone Again Naturally.
Two very different songs.
Yeah, and I've said before that I do feel like my life has been dictated by those two very separate concepts of like the self-pitying new man invented in the 70s by like the post-60s sensitivity, and an alien singing about fame with a pitch transposer. Sort of somewhere between those two things lies my life.
When a little while from now, if I'm not feeling any less sound, I promise myself to treat myself and visit a nearby town. And climbing to the top, will throw myself off in an effort to make clear to whoever what it's like when you're shattered, left standing in the lurch at a church where people saying, my God, that's tough, she stood him up. No point in us remaining, we may as well. I did on my own, alone again, naturally. To think that only yesterday
I was. And what about the gig? What about the first gig where you, because people, you know, there's gigs and there's gigs that you see and you feel an affinity with the band, or you feel somewhere within you, maybe I could do that.
Well, I always felt like, I was always like, I'm going to make music.
Really, from the start?
From the start. From as a little kid, like, I had a tape recorder, and from when I was very, very little, I got coffee cans, and I would get 2 tape recorders, and I'd play drums on coffee cans, and I'd borrow my sister's guitar, and I'd play guitar, and then I'd, you know, record while playing back the other tape. So I always was like, I want to make music. I never felt like, oh, one day, maybe I can make music. I was always like, I can make music. I just didn't think that I had anything. Deep down, didn't think I had anything of value to add. It took a long time. I think as a little kid, you just want to be the other person. Like, you want to be like, oh, I want to be David Bowie. You don't go, I want to make music and find out what I'm about because I'm 7.
Okay.
So like when a kid wants to write a story, they very seldom, unless you're writing the basketball diaries, you're very seldom writing about your actual life as a kid. You tend to like want to write a fantasy story or a science fiction story or a spy story. You very seldom are like writing a story about like being an insecure 11-year-old, because you don't think that's of any interest to anybody. But if a kid could actually write that
it would be amazing.
Incredible, you know. So I always felt I wanted to make music. But I went and saw a couple of shows. That I went to a birthday party, saw Men at Work at the Radio City Music Hall.
Wow.
My friend's birthday party. Then another friend of mine's father got tickets from a business thing. Like, you know, he was a couch salesman, and somebody had tickets to the Jackson's Victory Tour at Madison Square Garden.
What do you remember about that?
I just remember being very big and weird, and we were very far away, and I didn't understand the point. And in fact, like, all in that very same time period, I went and saw the Ramones, and then 1 week later, Iggy Pop at this place called City Gardens, which is what I thought was always just like a very normal punk club, like rock club. But there's a documentary and a book coming out about this place, and apparently it was like the most terrifying. I was a bouncer there when I was 17, 18, 19 years old, and I thought it was like, this is what clubs are like. This is what, you know, you go to a rock club, it's like this, unless it's like some boring rock club. And I realized that most boring rock clubs are what rock clubs are like. It's like, I honestly thought, like, I remember going to CBGB's for the first time when I moved to New York and being like, I thought this would be tougher. Like, it looked tough, but the people were quite sane, and, you know, a lot of college kids and stuff like that. Whereas City Gardens was terrifying. And like, yeah, there's blood all the time. Like, blood all the time.
That's a good name for something, for a book, Blood All the Time.
And there's a great, there's a book, there's a photo of Randy Now, who was like the prime booking guy. And he's like him standing by the cash register with the thing. It says, no slam dancing, no spikes. Like, it was like, there were rules. Like, because you could come in with like spikes and just punch each other in the head. But I didn't really go to like the, I missed a lot, many of the hardcore shows, unless it was like Bad Brains or something like that I also found interesting. I wasn't super into like macho hardcore. But yeah, I went and saw Ramones there when I was a kid, and that was a real eye-opener. And I wasn't a huge Ramones fan. I had a Ramones shirt since I had been like 8, and I liked them. I always felt like the Ramones and the Sex Pistols and the Go-Go's all had something more in common than I wanted to acknowledge. Like, that they all had like there was like a real like simple 60s rock structure to them, which was part of their greatness and appeal, but it also felt like, oh, this isn't weird enough for me in a way. Whereas I went and saw Iggy Pop, and that was just much weirder to me. And I liked both of those shows a lot.
What's the Iggy track we should play?
Oh, geez. That's a tough
one. Yeah, it's a tough one.
I mean, you could go for a Stooges track. You could do Penetration. It's a great track.
I want to talk about when you first started to remix other bands, when you first started to work with other bands. How did you start working on something like that?
Well, when I started doing that, I never literally listened to remixes. I didn't really care. I didn't listen to dance music or much of that, really, until I met Tim Goldsworthy, who came over with David Holmes, and we started working together. So I was puzzled. I didn't understand how any of this worked. To me, it seemed like I was listening to like disco stuff and other things, and we always just approached it as like, let's just make something new over this and try and experiment with things. I like the remixes that are like literally mixes where you might have some more congas, like the old style But when we started doing remixes, we just made new things. And that was always really fun to me. But they took a long time. They would take us weeks to do. You know, we're just playing around really for fun and trying to make things that were danceable, but also just like not sounding like other things at the time. I've only done one remix in the last 5 years, so.
Are you tempted to go back?
A little bit. It's fun. But really, it was a big part of my life for a long time. And
no.
I'm not. It takes a long time for me to do it. I did the David Bowie mix, and that took me weeks.
That's David Bowie as well, so there's more pressure there.
Yeah, it was like double panic. And so, you know, I'll do it once in a while. I just don't like... I don't want to do things on schedules. Like, in other words, like if someone's like, oh, we need a remix for this, can you do it? It's for this single. I won't do them for single. Like, in other words, if someone wants me to do a remix, if the song is right, I'll just do it. And when it's done, it's done, and you can do what you want with it. If I make something that I really believe in and like, you can have it. And as long as you put it on vinyl, I can have it. Because that's kind of the only thing I have at home to listen to music on. So.
DFA remix of House of Jealous Lovers by The Rapture, produced by Tim Goldsworthy, and my guest this week on the first time, James Murphy. And that was the pair's first release on their DFA record label in March 2002. One of the things I find very interesting about you and LCD is because you've talked a lot about coming to the band older, and this seems to be very much a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, you've learned a lot of stuff by the time the band gets successful. You've learned your craft a bit better and you know what you want and how to express it. But on the other hand, you think a lot about stuff. You seem to overanalyze a lot of your moves in a way that a younger band don't. So you're kind of cursed and blessed.
I think that's also who I am. Like, I'm overanalytical. And what that meant when I was young is I was very unproductive. Analyzing things meant I didn't do anything. Or it meant I shot myself in the foot really quickly or just panicked or I just hated what I did. So I think I actually needed the years. I wasn't talented enough, I think, as a young person, or charismatic enough to overcome my insecurities. I meet young bands sometimes, and like some of them are really insecure, but they're getting so much yes from the world. Like, some people are like, you're amazing. And they're like, oh, I mean, who, what, you know, 19-year-old doesn't want to hear that. Like, I mean, if somebody told me I was amazing, so hook, line, sinker, yes, thank you.
So you had to wait till you were more talented, more interesting.
I was not going to be more talented, and only life would make me more interesting if I was to be more interesting. Young people's music game is a different thing, I think. There's a lot of charm and magic involved in it, and I found my place where I thought there was, I can do this without charm or magic. I can be very anti-charming and very anti-magical and kind of explain what I'm doing in the song while doing the song and kind of try to be as like normal as possible. Because I felt like, sort of like what I said before, but like if an 11-year-old could actually write a story about what it's like to be an 11-year-old, I think it would be compelling. And I felt like if a 30-year-old would just write songs about being an insecure musician who's failed and 30 years old, it wound up being more compelling than all the years of me trying to write music, writing like I was somebody else.
Yeah.
But 44-year-old, this is not that interesting. Just be honest about
it. It peaks.
Right out of the gate, you know. What? My leg hurts. It's not like a compelling song. I have to get more blood tests now. The fifth album, I need more blood tests now.
See Radio 6 Music.
6 Music.
Yeah, I'm losing my edge. I'm losing my edge. The kids are coming up from behind. I'm losing my edge. I'm losing my edge to the kids from France and from London. But I was there. I was there in 1968. I was there at the first Cannes show in Cologne. Losing my edge. I'm losing my edge to the kids whose footsteps I hear when they get on the decks. I'm losing my edge to the internet seekers who can tell me every member of every good group. 1962 to 1978, although I'm losing my edge. I'm losing all the kids to the art school, Brooklynites and Berlin in little jackets and borrowed nostalgia for the unremembered 80s. Well, I'm losing my edge.
You know what you really want.
Welcome back. I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is James Murphy, and that was Losing My Edge by James's band, LCD Sound System.
Losing My Edge was the first LCD Sound System single, 2002. You've kind of said that it almost encapsulated so much of what you wanted to do with the band straight away. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is brilliant.
And then be like, all right, well, now I'm done.
We can just stop. Yeah. We've lyrically, and the sound is great. Do you still feel that way about that track?
I mean, yeah. I mean, I think it's like if I had an era... bands have eras. You'd be like, oh, like the Rolling Stones, they had their like real blues, aping just the blues in the beginning, and then they have like the, you know, they had their psych era, and then like, you know, for me, it's like I had an era, and that was that song. And I had people, you know, like, you should make another song like Losing My Edge. I'm like, really? Like, should I really do that? Like, that's a terrible idea. Like, that's a nightmare idea. You know, that was a very true thing for me, and it wasn't good because it was like a brilliant idea. If people liked it, I think it was because it was like a true thing out of me. And to ape it would be a really untrue thing. So it was going to be like, the closer I would get to the original, the farther away I would be getting in another way. It got so much attention that I panicked. I was like, oh no, like this was not the plan at all. Like I was just going to put out a little single and, you know, go back to producing. And I was also like, I don't want the pressure on the next 12-inch. So I quickly had a song that I had recorded, and I finished another thing and put out a 7-inch, and I tried not to do any press. I was like, let's just put out a 7-inch as if it's already been out. Because I think that would be nicer to be able to find a, you know, oh, this one came out beforehand. Like pretending that the 7-inch had come out before, but because the first 12 had gotten a decent amount of attention, then the 7-inch got attention. I was like, oh, now I'm really trapped. And since there was so much attention on the lyrics, I made Yeah, which was the dumbest lyrics. I was like, I'm going to make literally the worst lyrics possible by just saying Yeah. And there was originally going to be no other lyrics, and then there was a little bit of extra lyrics, but it was just the dumbest song I could come up with. And then after that, I was like, okay, I'll go make an album. Like, that was like kind of like an era, and... yeah, what a funny thing. I just tried to make the dumbest lyrics I could. Worked out, I think. They were dumb.
Was there a specific moment when you first thought, I'm going to retire the name LCD Sound System, I am going to draw a veil over this for all the love I have for it? Was that
from the beginning? But I never felt about retiring the name. It was just more like once it became a professional band, once we were a professional rock outfit, which all of us found hilarious.
As soon as you've got your name on the flight cases, that's it. It's done.
Well, we did that from the beginning because we thought that was funny as well. The thing was, once the irony went out of it, I don't mean irony in the cheap sense, but once it was like, as a band, we always felt like someone's going to walk up and be like, at any moment, be like, oh, okay, you guys, all right, joke's up. Well, we get it. Out. You're not allowed to play at this festival. Go home. When that was like not happening, because it was, I felt like we'd snuck into the party. But I think from the beginning, we always knew it was temporary. And I never wanted to retire the name so much as I just wanted to stop being a professional rock band with a career trajectory and, you know, building on past success and, you know, making a plan for the next LP and all that kind of stuff.
When you say it like that, it sounds so awful.
It's not. I mean, it's necessary, and I think it's like it depends on what you want out of it. No one in the band signed up for that. Everybody signed up for a long weekend. Like, quite literally everyone. I told everyone we're going to go play two shows in London and a show in Glasgow, and that was the end of it. And no one would have agreed to more because they were in other bands, they had kids, they had lives. And then it kept being like, all right, well, maybe there's a couple more shows. And it just, you know, it went on and became a part of our lives. And it's you know, it's a hard Band-Aid to rip off, but at some point it just had to happen. And I definitely thought when we did it was the funniest and full time to do it. It felt like, it's hard to say when I say full, it just felt like there was a lot of, like, density and complexity in the moment of going, okay, we're done, and then we'll play this big show and that'll be it.
Killing it with close inspection, killing it can only make it work, sort of makes it free.
In terms of the actual concert, you probably don't remember the end of it. Do you remember that first song, walking out on stage and thinking this is the start
of the last time I will play these songs?
My memories of the show are so weird because it's a film, and so the film supersedes your memory, like photographs do for people. I think there's a lot of adrenaline and booze. Some of those two are interesting, do interesting things to the memory, I've learned, or I've heard.
Arcade Fire feature on the record and on the concert, and you worked with them quite recently. When did you first meet them? Did you enjoy that process working with them?
I loved it. I didn't know that I would. I like working with bands sometimes, but sometimes it's exhausting because you're just dealing with a lot of band politics. Typically, you have people's insecurities rather than just working on the music, and communication is tough. You have to learn how a band communicates with each other, but they were actually really incredibly easy to work with, which I didn't know that. And we've known each other for a long time. We've been friends for a long time, but you don't know until you've worked with somebody in the studio. It could be a disaster. But in fact, it was really pleasant, and there was a really clear role for me, which I didn't know. They didn't know either. We didn't know what my job was going to be.
Right.
They're like, why don't you come and just hang out for a couple of songs? There's a few things. Like, in their mind, I think it was like, you come and you just do some, you know how to use drum machines. Like, you'll work on that. There's a couple things. And then, in fact, there was a process of mine, which is a little boring, but was very, I think, very helpful.
Which is?
I mix constantly. I mix from the beginning.
So you're working out the overall mix of the song?
If they've only tracked the drums, I'm mixing the drums.
Which doesn't happen normally.
No, well, I don't know. I don't know how other people work. I haven't seen it, but a lot of times I don't think so, because they are so many people and they work so fast. Like, Inspiration, kind of, they have their own studio and they have a control room that's in the studio. There's no separate control room. And they'll be like working on overdubs for a song and writing. And then they'll be like, oh, wait, no, we want to record. And they're Mark Lawson, their incredible engineer, is like, he's like Scotty in the classic Star Trek. It was like somebody threw a bunch of furniture in a room and I'd be like moving the furniture around and be like, is this an okay setup? And it was nice. It was like really homey for me. It was really engineer-y for me and really like soothing. And it was, I think they had a good time. Everybody seemed to be, you know, pretty happy. So, I mean, we all went crazy. Isn't that what you're supposed to say? I think you're supposed to say something like that.
Something like that.
Yeah. It's nothing like your lives, people. It was crazy. It was the most normal thing. We're just making sandwiches and making songs. In a prison, in a prison of fire, alone in the darkness, darkness of wire, we fell in love, alone on a stage, in the reflect of age. Entre la nuit, la nuit l'aurore, entre le royaume des vivants et des morts. If this is heaven, I don't know.
So tell me about Suicide. That is a name that always crops up with you as a big reference.
Well, it's a band. It's two guys, one who played organ slightly out of time and one who yelled like Elvis Presley into a delay and wore like biker outfits and started in the early 70s.
What's not to like?
Well, everyone hated them and they were called Suicide. I'm sorry. I think that's just like, at first they were called Life and then they changed their name to Suicide.
I didn't know that.
And whenever I think about like the decisions I make or the decisions that modern bands are asked to make, and then I think about that band that they called themselves Suicide and it ruled so hard and everybody would throw things at them, and now they're like, I mean, it's just accepted that they're great, you know. Yeah. they're super cool, and it's a good, people like that are good to just remember, to keep in your mind about when you're making decisions, like what would Alan Vega do would be a great bracelet for me, you know. What would Martin Rev do? Beautiful music too, like beautiful, like those Martin Rev solo records is on. They're beautiful, beautiful music. Just very, very strange.
Diamonds are full of cool champagne. A woman up at a lab, cocaine. Melodies are spewing.
Coffee. When did you fall in love with coffee? Because your brand, your coffee bean, your coffee...
It's an espresso blend.
Thank you.
I like coffee a lot. There are things I like sometimes are a little consistent or a little inconsistent. I wanted to make a coffee that was a slightly darker, more traditional roast that held up to milk. It's much lighter than like what people think of as espresso, but it's very nerdy stuff. I'm just like... I mean, I'm in my retirement, I finally have the time to nerd out about stuff that I was nerding out with about before the band, which overtook my life. So coffee was one of them always. I don't know. I like anything you can be a beginner at and learn about.
And the final thing we ask everybody, you get to pick the last song.
I would say Bill Is Dead by The Fall.
Why that song?
It's a beautiful, beautiful song. I love beautiful songs by people who make challenging music. I think they're always more powerful than... the prettiest song by a person who makes a bunch of pretty songs. I find the pretty songs by pretty song people to be...
ugly?
Just disposable. The lyrics are incredibly good, and it's melancholy, which is not really The Fall. It's like an unusual Fall song, and some of the best imagist writing, like, you know, a la Arthur Russell, kind of like great lyrics. And I think his lyrics are always great, but these are like really something special, I think.
It's been a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you very much.
Well, likewise.
Last week, after a dynasty, I had crow's feet under my eyes. Paid 2 days for getting high. Wheezing, got pasted in a bar. I hope I've got the number. These are the finest times of my life. This is the greatest time of my life. This is the greatest time of my life. These are the biggest times of my life.
Biggest times of my life. is the finest time of my life. These are the greatest times of my life.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
This is Handpicked, a weekly playlist put together by Six Music that you can download in BBC Sounds. Now, usually Handpicked is full of new music, but this week we squeezed in as many legendary punk bands and tracks as we can fit into half an hour, all of which were played by Craig Charles in his Trunk of Punk while he's been in for Steve Lamacq on Six Music. Steve's back this week every day from 4. The full version of this Handpicked punk mix will be out on Wednesday. Just search Handpicked in BBC Sounds to find it. But now, though, we begin with the Stooges.
I'm a skeet walking cheetah with a high